It's The Wonky Show. Today we're talking about the legal and political fallout from Michelle Donlan's attack on some academics she didn't like, new polling into the student condition, and what was, or really, what wasn't, in the budget. It's all coming up.
The three that I think she was really in breach of were integrity, objectivity and leadership. I'm probably very naive, but I still find it bizarre that someone in such a senior position can behave with such little integrity or self-reflection.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news policy analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to limit the damage from the week in higher education are three fantastic guests as always. In Hampton Hill, it's Sian Waring, incoming Vice Chancellor, Middlesex University. Sian, your heart of the week, please.
I think it's a pudding. It was a creme caramel I had for supper last night.
Nice. I think that's our first pudding of 2024. Excellent. I should also mention I am a governor of Middlesex University. In Reading, it's Ben Elgar, Chief Executive of the Office for the Independent Adjudicator. That's the OIA to you and me. Ben, your heart of the week, please.
This week, my partner Julie has secured for us tickets to the Elvis Costello concert in September for my birthday at the London Palladium, no less.
Excellent. Sounds like a fun night out. And somewhere else on the M4 corridor, of higher education, it's David Kernahan, DK to you and me, Deputy Editor of Wonky. DK, your heart of the week, please.
Well, it's not happened yet, but immediately after this podcast recording is completed, I am going down the CAF for a cooked breakfast, which I'm immensely looking forward to.
Interesting. I'm liking all these kind of personal highlights. It's much more interesting than your, professional achievements. Good. Okay. Right. We start the week with the big news, the humiliating legal woes of Michelle Donlan. DK, walk us through what is going on here.
Right. So back in October of last year, in her capacity as Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, Michelle Donlan wrote a letter to UK Research and Innovation because she was concerned that a member of the Research England Expert Advisory Group, Kate Sang, had been undertaking social media activity that suggested she supported a proscribed terrorist group, Hamas. There has been an investigation since conducted with the support of the Ukraine board that reported early on Wednesday, and it found that there was no case to answer. Effectively, she was not supporting terrorism in any way. It later transpired she had also made a claim for libel, and Michelle Donlan had to get the department to pay a sum not adjacent to £15,000 to Kate Sang as a means of compensating her for the damage caused by her letter.
Right, and we have a clip of an interview around the time she sent the letter on the radio. Here it is.
But Research England is an independent body. Mm. You're not alleging that this individual has broken the law. No. So is it for ministers to be telling an independent body who they should have on a committee? Because you don't like what she said.
So I think if you read the letter, I didn't say you must take the following steps. I said that I strongly recommend and I...
Let's
look at UKRI's response. UKRI's own response was that they too are deeply concerned and shocked about this and that they are going to take action and investigate it. Now, they wouldn't be saying that if they thought everything was hunky-dory. And I don't think that anybody would suggest that is reasonable, that the promotion of terrorism is okay.
Oh, man, he has it there. I mean, you can see why they sued her. I mean, Sian, this is fascinating, isn't it? Because we've got the constant rumblings about free speech on the one hand, and then you've got this kind of extraordinary intervention that starts this, immense kind of internal process at UKRI and, gathers all sorts of headlines. I mean, obviously it was reckless, wasn't it, of the minister to accuse someone of supporting terrorism, but kind of why do you think that situation even came about?
Reckless isn't the half of it. I think I found it really bizarre that the minister could accuse two people of breaching the principles of public life while blatantly herself breaching the Nolan principles of public life. So the three that I think she was really in breach of were integrity, objectivity and leadership. And I'm probably very naive, but I still find it bizarre that someone in such a senior position can behave with such little integrity or self-reflection. And I know that the two academics that Donlan accused, Professor Sang and Dr. Patel, were very unhappy about how UKRI handled the investigation. But I think, you know, it's an absolute score for law, regulation and its processes that it does protect the general public from the abuse of power by individuals. And I'm sort of thinking as well about the American elections coming up. It shows how important regulation and judicial processes are to protect democracy. So I think there's a glimmer of light in there, but it reminds us how important independence and objectivity are in protecting democracy, I think, from behaviour like this.
Yeah, so a victory for process in some ways. I'm fascinated by this. I want both Ben and DK's view as well, because DK, you wrote at the time that UKI had handled the situation pretty well in you know, starting this whole investigation and the way it responded and everything. But I wonder if we look back with hindsight, and you know, that if the academics had been allowed to explain their position, then clearly the minister was libelling them. And you know, why did UKRI feel that it had to just roll over as soon as Michelle Donnellan kind of opened her mouth on the radio?
In the bluntest way possible, because Michelle Donnellan signs the checks. If, as was hinted in the clip we just heard, if an average person libels somebody on Twitter, that's a bad deal. If a Secretary of State does it, and it's the Secretary of State responsible for the organisation that has just employed you to advise them, then that is a whole other deal. Despite all of the protections built into the Higher Education Research Act, which limit the amount of things that the Secretary of State can do to get UKRI to do things, that idea of academic independence, of autonomy to a certain respect, and the old Haldane principle that, I mean, ministers don't get involved in what research is done or how it is performed or assessed. In practice, if you have got an angry Secretary of State, you have to act. I think this is a stronger verdict because we have been through that investigatory process. I know it was a painful process. It is horrible to be investigated for something that you patently have not done. I mean, a number of us have been through situations in which they've been investigated at work for something that they just patently haven't done and is absolutely complete nonsense. But the fact that this process has completed and it has found no evidence of any wrongdoing, this is a very powerful finding. It puts a lot more pressure on Michelle Donnellan, and puts a lot more pressure on the government more generally, who have increasingly gotten into the habit of criticizing people who are effectively serving the public.
Okay, so this is fascinating, Ben, because you run an organization that, you know, has its checks written by government ministers, essentially. If something came to you like this, would you say, yes, let's stop everything, let's do a long, painful investigation? Or would you say, no, hold on a second, you can't accuse people of terrorism that you know, can't accuse people of supporting terrorists when they haven't. And, you know, that's the end of the story.
It's very hard to know, isn't it, until you're in this situation, exactly what you would do. I think we're lucky in terms of, you know, what you said about writing the checks, because we really are at two removes there in terms of the way we're funded by the sector. And I've always thought that does give us a kind of extra layer of protection. And certainly what I'd like to think we would do is we would stand up for our independence.
I agree. I think it's very hard to know what you'd do. And given that the sector was under attack, we can't look insular. So I think UKRI would definitely be between a rock and a hard place on this one. And I think going for transparency was probably the preferred option, although I understand that they could have pushed back harder. I mean, I think they navigated that pretty well, actually. But I'm also really interested in the contradictions in freedom of speech legislation, which Jim's pointed out on the Wonky website. It's really fascinating seeing the government come unstuck on its own legislation so fast. Where actually they're protected by their own legislation from the things they want to happen.
It really does show, doesn't it, the challenges that providers and student organisations are going to have in these judgments between different people's free speech and between Free Speech and Equality Act issues. And they're certainly going to need a lot of help and understanding to get it right.
Mm. It's not the first time Michelle Donnellan's got herself in a complete tangle over exactly that when she tried talking about Holocaust denial and whether that was going to be covered by the free speech legislation. I mean, yeah, it's a kind of minefield that they have lain out.
Do you remember the advert for the Minions movie that used to go by on the bus, which one of them said, "I make the rules," and the one said, "I break the rules," and the third one said, "The rules don't apply to me."
There's a sort of government governance point to this, isn't there, which doesn't, you know, in fairness, isn't just about one politician, which is, you know, something we saw really in the pandemic, which is about how government business should be conducted and whether really that should be, you know, by weekend tweets relying on outside bodies advice and acting as a lobbyist rather than the governor.
Yeah, I think that goes back to the Nolan principles, actually. I think that's why they exist. Those seven principles of public life, they're there to guide us through those sort of situations. And I find it absolutely astonishing that the minister could be so blatantly in breach of them.
It's also, I mean, it's a sign of the times, isn't it, in terms of, you know, the culture wars, where, you know, most ministerial pronouncements are just there for, you know, a headline the next day or to create a bit of a row on, you know, in the air war, essentially. And, you know, all of that can kind of backfire massively if you ever set the mark. I mean, a lot of the political chat this week has been about this 15K that it has cost the taxpayers, as it turns out. So Michelle Donlan herself hasn't had to stump up the money. But there is growing pressure on that, isn't there, DK?
There is. For me, it's a little bit of a red herring. The libel didn't occur necessarily in the tweet. It occurred in the letter that was tweeted out. The letter was tweeted in her capacity as Secretary of State. I mean, it was on the headed note paper, all of the rest of it. So we don't know for certain if the libel case was made against Michelle Donlan personally or against the Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology. So it's possibly a little less cut and dried, but I believe you are correct in that the optics of this are dreadful as we will get to later in the podcast, in a situation where we're looking at essentially no real terms increase in public spending for the rest of the decade. The idea that a minister can do something as utterly stupid as this and then have the taxpayer bailing them out, it does not look very good at all. It was noticeable Michelle Donlan didn't even come into the chamber for the actual budget statement itself. She was sitting up in the gallery with the journalists for some reason.
And there's a real danger, isn't there, of kind of losing the wider point. At the moment, the situation in the Middle East has a real impact on Jewish and Muslim and other students and people in universities. And really, there's a real need for everyone with a platform, especially a sort of privileged platform, to be really mindful of the consequences of what they're saying, including on social media, and dialing down the rhetoric instead of up.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Nicola Watchman-Smith, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the challenges and the practical action we can take in the student belonging space. In the blog, I've suggested a shift in the notion of value added and educational gain, proposing that the activities and interventions outside of the classroom are as integral to those inside of that teaching space. Alongside this, I've shamelessly publicised our new Student Belonging Good Practice Guide, written with my colleagues Claire Garden and Connor Norton, and in association with the wonderful RAISE Network. The guide is jam-packed with hints, tips, case studies and student opinion that we hope will really help universities and colleges that are looking to do student belonging in a practical and enhanced way. Happy reading.
So there's been new polling into the student condition. Ben, give us the highlights.
This is a follow-up to the original Student Futures Commission, which was convened by the UPP Foundation to help understand the impact of the pandemic on students. The new report, which is based actually on research from Sybil and Public First, does actually note some reasons for optimism, with the majority of students feeling happy at university and saying that they're working at the academic level they expected. But to be honest, many of the other headlines are really concerning: high levels of loneliness, disengagement, especially from extracurricular activities. And the support suggests this is driven both by financial pressures and an increasingly transactional relationship between students and providers. The number of students rely on significant hours of paid work is really highlighted here, and a better maintenance offer to students is one of the main asks. And it's also noted international students are particularly likely to feel shortchanged given the higher fees they're paying. Report concludes this means we're moving from a lost learning crisis to a cost of learning crisis.
Yeah, I thought it was a good line that. Sean, what jumps out at you reading this?
Well, obviously it's good to see the good news. And I suppose I think in the sector we need to hang on to the fact that, you know, a lot of students do have their lives changed still by higher education and graduate successfully, but obviously very sad to see the extent of that. I think particularly the loneliness and the disengagement. I think we're seeing the aftermath of COVID, the cost of living crisis and the HE funding crisis all coming together here and impacting on some of the most vulnerable people in society. I would say young people, often young people, not only, but often young people who don't necessarily have you know, financial protection around them in terms of family. They don't yet have the option of graduate level jobs, and it's like, it feels a bit like society is casting them adrift. And I think lots of people in the sector will be really sad reading this. I think the sector's done a lot to modernise our systems to be more consistent, but I think there's always more we can do. And I don't think on the funding models that we have at the moment, we can bridge those growing gaps. And I think that's a risk that exposes students and universities, despite how hard the majority of staff in higher education work to bridge these gaps. So, yeah, I think there's a, I don't suppose anybody reads this without feeling empathy and pity for, that we've got to this state.
ZTK, it's a war, isn't it? Because, I mean, how many years can we keep, you know, reading data like this before something has to give somewhere in the system?
The bit that really concerns me in this report, it's about students' expectations not being met. The report says students in a focus group frequently reported feeling underwhelmed by the university experience. And this coupled with a lack of agency that students feel over their university experience, that is really, really troubling stuff. A lot of the talk about the value of the university experience is that students have got the chance to, for the want of a better word, to find themselves, to understand who they are, what they're interested in, to develop new interests, make new friends, that kind of thing. And there is a sense that students are not able to do that. For me, and I think the report does this pretty well as well, the link is back to the cost of living crisis. If you haven't got enough money to live on without working shifts every evening, the choice of whether you go out to a student society event or stay in and get to know your housemates or go to the library, all of which are completely valid choices. I mean, they just don't count anymore. You can't make that choice if you don't have the funds to do so. The maintenance offer has effectively ossified since, I think we abolished the last of the grants in 2016. The threshold for the point where the maximum amount of loan that's available to you for maintenance starts to reduce hasn't changed since 2012. The whole system is ripe to be refreshed and urgently needs to be done. And if we are going to have any impact on the next generation of students and the expectations of university that they rightly have, the question always comes back, as we will get to later in the podcast, about the state of the public finances. Can we afford to make a better maintenance offer within the current student finance system? I would argue probably not. We do need to be looking at a more radical refresh. And unfortunately, reports like this are just more and more evidence that we need to seriously look at student maintenance and student support. It's the biggest issue the sector is facing right now.
It really feels, doesn't it, like we've got a system designed around a lot of students being in full-time study who in reality are not, because they're basically in full-time work. And inevitably, they're now comparing their experience with other students who are students now and also from predecessor students, and unsurprisingly finding that that is not what they were hoping for or wanted.
The comparison almost is with their parents' experience. These are the kids of the cohort who went to university in the early to mid-90s. They're more likely than any other generation to have both parents, but at least one parent that have been to university. And the comparison is with the student experience now and the experience that was available in the 90s to their parents. Now, I'm not saying things were perfect in the 90s. Far from it. The sector was facing a serious funding crunch. Grants was at a way to nothing. Loans were very low. But it did feel like, more generally in the student experience, that there was the capacity to have those other experiences. A lot of people did work at university in the 90s, but it was not as actually universal, and it was not as intense as it is now.
It's so noticeable, isn't it, how many people you meet in the sector doing important roles now will say that so much of their experience and expertise started at university, but not in the lecture theatre, you know, from their extracurricular activities, working in student unions, whatever.
My current university of Northampton, working with the student union, is looking at student accommodation, and we've got some accommodation which students say is too pricey, and we've got some accommodation that students say needs refurbishment. So the accommodation which we get the feedback needs refurbishing is really well priced for students, and the accommodation which is new, is obviously some students find it too expensive, and I think lots of universities would be in that position. You think that we have no way to meet this need. We have, we have reined in capital expenditure programs because of funding pressure. And where we're lucky enough to have the new build accommodation, it's not necessarily in the price range for many students, but students would like accommodation that meets the standards they expect at a price they can afford. And we can absolutely see that we've actually got a spectrum of accommodation that covers both quality and price. And for many students, that's just not working.
I think this is why we're seeing as well, isn't it, even though universities and providers are facing so many financial challenges, there is a real consensus now, you know, not just through student organisations, but I think through university representative bodies as well, that the maintenance issue is the first issue that has to be fixed.
And if you haven't got a home to go back to, it's always going to feel lonely at university, isn't it? Whether that's a room that feels like your room or a family home, you need a home at university. I'm the chair of a charity that provides homes at university for students who are estranged or care experienced, and we know that's absolutely transformative for students. So I really that point about accommodation really strikes home to me, because I think you need somewhere to go to and close the door and feel secure, and I think that's a fundamental challenge at the moment. So I agree with Ben about the maintenance. I guess one thing I'd say is I think it's still a question of degree, and I know it's easy when we get reports like this and headlines to see it as very binary, but I think it's really important that we hold on to the fact that students do come, and many students speak very highly of their experience, and many students go on and graduate and access the lives of graduates. That's really important to us. So it's really important that we take a responsible response to this report, that we see the trend, we do what we can within institutions to address it, and we take our role in raising the profile of the challenges and risks outside to policymakers and funders. But still to remember that many students come through higher education successfully and go on to what they're hoping to afterwards.
You can find out more about the polling and the research and Student Futures Part 2 at the Secret Life of Students, which we're holding next week. Links in the show notes. Budget week. Sean, give us the highlights.
So the government announced the spring budget on Wednesday. Our expectations were that the budget wouldn't mention higher education, and those expectations were met. We expect it to be the last budget before a general election. I've heard May and October as the 2 months considered most likely. In terms of the overall budget, it looked like the government hedged its bets with some of the adjustments that you'd expect from a Conservative government. But they also borrowed from the Labour playbook, closing the loophole in the tax system for non-domiciled UK residents, for example, or the non-doms. And that appears to be with the intention of wrong-footing the opposition in the approach to the election. But for us, it leaves us out in the wilderness regarding funding. So this was anticipated, but nevertheless unfortunate for us and for the communities that we serve. So I was at the UUK conference, the Vice-Chancellor's Conference, last week, and we had a presentation there on recent polling of public opinion of HE. And the three headlines I took away was that the public generally think HE is a good thing. They recognise that underfunding of the sector is a significant risk, and they don't want to pay more for it. So that is the reality and the quandary that any incoming government is going to have to deal with. So I think at the minute there isn't enough money to go around, and we're not a vote attractor for either the incumbent government or the opposition.
Yeah, yeah. The other interesting, I guess, assumption based on this week's budget is what's going to happen with the spending review. I mean, there's definitely not going to be one before the election, which means that Labour's essentially going to have to inherit Tory spending plans for at least a year while it does, if it wins the election, that is, while it does its own spending review, which further puts kind of, you know, some relief into the further distance, isn't it, DK?
So yes, the spending review is the big next moment for people who are concerned about the public accounts and about sector finances. We know that this budget has set a growth of 1% in the total of public sector funding all the way through to 2029. That is likely to be substantially below inflation. So we're looking at a real terms cut, and that is particularly likely to affect areas of spending that are not ring-fenced. So we might see increases for the NHS or for schools, which would again put further pressure on the rest of spending. And I'm afraid that higher education is probably quite a long way down that list. Although it's becoming increasingly fear that it's becoming increasingly clear that we are facing a serious financial crisis in the sector with lots of little things the government could do, but seemingly no willingness to actually go ahead and do them. We don't know very much about the plans for higher education coming from Labour. It's something we've written about on the site before. The best we can understand it is that the idea of this perennial culture war against universities from the government is likely to come to an end, which would be a huge relief to many of us, but is unlikely to help the financial situation of universities. I also quickly wanted to go through, there were a couple of little bits in the budget that did deal with universities. On the floor of the House, Jeremy Hunt actually said that outside the US, we have the most respected universities, the biggest financial service sector, and the largest tech ecosystem in Europe. So we can take of that what we may. In terms of what's in the red book, there's still stuff ongoing in university spin-outs. The OFS registered National Film and Television School got a government grant subject to a business case submission, which is linked to an extension there, planning, and to Jeremy Hunt's priorities around the creative industries. We got the numbers on the Ukrainian permission extension scheme, which means Ukrainian refugee students can be eligible for home student loans. It's confirmed through at 28-29, total cost £20-25 million. And there was a little update there in investment zones. But I mean, as you say, very, very slim pickings.
I can't believe you missed off the agri-food launchpad.
As exciting as the agri-food launch punches are, I had momentarily forgotten about them. So thank you, Mark, for pointing that one out.
That was we're gonna hang the whole podcast of the agri-food launch pads, aren't we? Yeah.
It's going to be a special episode next week. You can all wait forward for that.
Ben, are you firing up your spending review submission responses?
I think this is the week, isn't it? It just makes you look at the other end of the telescope. We're just always thinking, well, sort of, how can someone not do something? We've got this system with, you know, where international students basically subsidising research and domestic students. We surely can't go on like that. And then you suddenly look at this budget and think, well, how can something be coming? Because as DK says, you know, in an education department where schools are going to be ring fenced, the reality is that the funding for universities and higher education is going to be even tougher, and it's going to be very difficult for an incoming government. And a lot of good people are doing a lot of good things to make the case, but it's going to be hard.
The question is what we're going to see on the ground as a result of this. We are going to see cuts to departments and academic jobs, as we're currently seeing. We're going to see a worsening student experience. Both in terms of the money available to students and the available funds to institutions to support them. We're going to see mergers and closures, and potentially all of this will combine to mean that the small decreases in applications that we saw in the January deadline, that also may continue. Couple that with the decline in international students, and the problems with the TPS pension scheme contributions, and just about every aspect of every part of the sector is in serious financial trouble. It's not yet a crisis. It is rapidly becoming a crisis, and there does need to be some kind of government action to at least examine the root causes of this and start to offer solutions.
Yeah, I agree. So we know that the sector's been, the funding model's been underpinned by international student recruitment, and that's just taken a dive this year as a result of government policy to make it harder for international students to come to the UK and to make them less welcome. So that's had a huge impact on budgets right across the sector, added to the decline in the value of the home undergraduate fee. Something else I think we've probably got in the accounts that hasn't come to light yet is so-called aged debt. So we've got international students, particularly from Ghana and Nigeria, where the relative, the economy has shifted. So fees that looked affordable to students perhaps a year ago are no longer affordable. So we've got students who signed up but now cannot afford the UK fees. And what you can start to see coming through the accounts is debt that's 90 or 180 days old. So that won't be in the published accounts. That will just be creeping through the system now. So I think it could be that the financial situation across the sector is worse even than what we can see at the moment.
And this is something that was confirmed by Susan Lapworth. She talked about what she's seeing from the financial returns that came in at the end of January when she spoke at the House of Commons committee the other week. So, I mean, in terms of sector data on finances, what is published is a long way back. Is a long way behind what we can actually see on the ground in institutions. So we do need to be aware of that, I mean, when we're making these cases to people.
There is one thing. So there was a paper published, Chris Husbands, the recently retired Vice-Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam University, has published a paper with King's College, at King's College, this week, and he talks about what the genuine options are, that there are very few options and that there are no easy answers. So he was suggesting radical options of kind of shared services, not necessarily mergers, but shared services and collective approaches to cost control across the sector. But one of the other possibilities, I think, is that we do see a government do a kind of a stealth approach to addressing finances by linking undergraduate home fees to inflation, which won't be an influx of cash to fix the hole in the sector, but it would be the start of perhaps a more stable funding model. Certainly in England, if we linked the undergraduate fee to inflation, but of course all four nations have got different funding models, and none of them are really meeting the requirements of the sector at the moment.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Ben, Sian and DK and Michael, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.